14th, 1980, a date that still means a lot to anybody who was living in the Northwest 42 years ago today. That was, of course, the day Mount St. Helens erupted. Our resident historian Felix Bunnell caught up with musician Chris Ballew for a story from that day about driving through darkness and ash and listening to the radio and the hunt for a mythical lost cassette tape. Felix is brought to us by Lake Washington Windows and Doors. Good morning.
Warren, Dave, yeah, there are so many stories from that event, and of course, we never want to forget that 57 lives were lost. Now, this story is one we touched on a bit for the 40th anniversary, which was kind of lost in the pandemic. I want to thank Freya Liggett from the Northwest Museum in Spokane for first bringing it to my attention. Chris Ballew was frontman for the Presidents of the United States when they had a series of hits back in the 1990s. He then morphed into the kids performer called Casper Baby Pants, which is a musical persona he did for about a decade. Now, 42 years ago, Chris was 14, and his younger brother Tim was 13. They're with their mom, Barbara, and family friend Gene Sifrin. They all drove to Spokane so Chris could go through his Catholic confirmation ceremony there. That mass was Sunday morning, May 18th, 1980. Ominous music. Okay. When it was over, they jumped in their car, Chris's dad's company car, which was a mid-70s Ford Granada. We all remember those. They headed west on I-90 to get back to Seattle. And somewhere east of Moses Lake, the distant sky started to look very strange.
We could see this big cloud coming over. We didn't have the radio on or anything. We didn't know. We didn't hear it in Spokane or feel it or anything. So we thought it was a storm. And as it approached and got closer and closer, it seemed to take up the entire sky. And we thought, wow, this storm is going to be epic. And then it went over the car, and then it went, kept going, traveling east, and we're on I-90 going west, and it kept traveling east, and pretty soon it shut off the horizon, and all of a sudden it was nighttime. And then we're like, okay, we need to turn on the radio.
All right. Now, that radio was an old JVC boombox belonging to Chris's mom, and fortunately, Barbara Ballew was something of an amateur documentarian, and she pressed record.
She had a call from a lady who said, what's going on? She was fishing at Loon Lake. They were driving into Spokane, didn't have the radio on, and this, so we better bring people up to date.
Yeah.
In case they just did tune in or coming in from a camping trip. This, of course, is volcanic ash falling from Mount St. Helens and caused the darkness if you didn't have your radio on or were watching television or whatever. And this is the result of the darkness. Also, had a report from Fairchild Air Force Base. A man was unpacking his camping gear and walking in toward the wind. So he says, do not do that, because his eye is full of ash. So this is volcanic ash falling from Mount St. Helens, causing the darkness here in Spokane areas.
That was Bob Swartz. He's an on-air personality, one of the founders of a station called KZUN, or Cousin, in Spokane Valley. So back in the westbound Granada, they found I-90 blocked by the state patrol at Moses Lake. So Chris's mom turned the car around and headed back towards Spokane. That's when things got pretty scary.
The windows of the car became hot to the touch, and we didn't know how much hotter they were going to get, so that was kind of freaky. My mom, who was driving, got vertigo and couldn't tell what was up and down, what was left and right. So my brother and I had to tell her when she was driving off the road to the left or the right, and the tape recording that she ended up making has a moment where it switches to the microphone on the tape deck, and you can hear my brother and I saying, Mom, you're driving off to the left, you're driving off to the right, with our impossibly high voices, part of which was because we were scared, but mostly because we were young kids.
And we have part of the moment when the boombox switches from the recording the radio to also recording what was going on inside the car.
In case we do go off the air from our mic peak location, and we'll be on the air from our smaller transmitter site here.
Yeah, on the right, but you're okay.
Doing good here.
You're
going off to the left. You're going to go off the road, right?
Throughout the county.
A couple seconds. Mom,
old FM
turn right.
Turn
right.
The mountain,
no, I'm not. I see the left one. I see the markers.
I do too.
I don't know if you've ever been in your car with your family, but that sounds very familiar to me.
It does.
Even when there's not a volcano going on, the turn to the right.
Wow.
Now, at one point, Barbara Ballew actually drove off the road and the car got stuck in a ditch. You know, the wheels were high-centered. They feared for their lives out there in the ashfall, but a Samaritan with a winch, which Washington's roads are filled with Samaritans with winches, fortunately, pulled them out and they continued on their way back to Spokane. Now, lots of people make tapes off the radio. I mean, I'm guilty of that. But very few people save those tapes or can get their hands on them 40 years later. And this particular tape was forgotten about and then almost lost forever. Chris Ballew's mom passed away in 2012. When she did, Chris inherited a big box of cassette tapes. And that jogged his memory, not about Mount St. Helens, but about when he was a teenager and was first starting to write and record his own music. In those days, he says, his allowance was such that new blank cassette tapes were a luxury. It was hard to come by.
So I used to steal my mom's French lesson cassettes. And so a lot of my early recordings had little French lesson bits in between them. But there was a four-song little cassette that I made way early in my career as a songwriter that I lost. And the atmosphere of those four songs has just sort of I'm constantly trying to recapture what I think they sounded like. And I thought, what if in this box of tapes I find that cassette with those four songs on it?
So that's why Chris listened to something like 80 tapes, listened from start to finish in that box from his mom. He was hoping to find what he calls his proto-Casper songs, little bouncy songs, he says, that are the earliest record of the artist that Chris became. That long-lost tape never turned up. It's still out there. Its mythicalness is only growing in stature as time goes by. But the Mount St. Helens tape did turn up. Now, all that volcanic ash meant that Chris and Tim and their mom and her friend were stuck in Spokane for about 10 days. The people they stayed with really liked Chinese takeout and had for years, and their long habit of saving containers made it easy for Chris to become a volcano entrepreneur.
Anytime they got, hot mustard in a little cup with a lid, they saved it. So they had hundreds and hundreds of these empty cups, and I filled them up with ash and brought them back to Seattle and sold them at school for 50 cents a pop. And I made $50 selling ash.
Wow.
And I still have a Sanka glass coffee container full of ash from Mount St. Helens here at the house.
And that's true. Anyone who's living around, you probably have a little homemade container of ash in your garage.
I didn't need to buy ash. Enough of it landed on my house.
And that song we heard at the top is called Volcano. That's by Chris's band, The Presidents. He said that song's not about surviving the Mount St. Helens, but the experience did put the volcanoes in his blood. He did officially retire Casper Baby Pants. He's recording new material, and those songs are available for free at his website. But I just love, as time goes by, more and more little stories about Mount St. Helens emerge. And the fact
story.
They have audio from it, just, I couldn't believe it. One of my favorite stories about that, by people surviving that volcanic eruption 42 years ago today.
That really brings it back to hear that. And the stories of people who were driving in their cars at the time.
I can't believe it. Yeah. Yep.
Felix Bunnell, all his features at mynorthwest.com. Thank you, Felix.
Thanks, Dave.
Let's take another look at the weather, because look outside today, you realize it's a little too early to put your rain boots away. We had a little bit of sunshine on Tuesday, but we're going to have a wet and windy day today. And with a closer look, here's Car Radio's Heather Bosch.
Spring can be a cruel mistress in the Puget Sound region. She gives us a day of sun breaks only to throw cold water on us the next day. National Weather Service meteorologist Jeff Mikulski.
We're back to more wet and windy and even snowy weather on Wednesdays.
Wait, did he say snow?
Yeah, so we're looking at snow levels, around 4,000 feet, maybe down to 3,500 feet, but that would definitely impact some of the Cascade passes.
But you don't need to head to the mountains to enjoy cool temperatures. After hitting 70 degrees one day in April, Mikulski says we haven't reached our average high temperature for May, 67 degrees once. Perhaps it would not feel so cold if it wasn't so damp so far this month.
This has been the second wettest May on record.
But if you can don your raincoat and ball cap for the next few days, there is light at the end of the tunnel, and that light, my friends, is the sun.
By Friday, and especially into Saturday, we're looking at dry weather, and we could maybe see temperatures closer to 70 degrees on Saturday.
But while even weather-hardened Seattleites might be grumbling, consider the silver lining in all these rain clouds.
We're not talking about drought in Western Washington, and it's keeping our fire weather season, on hold for now as things remain green, so definitely some benefits to having a wet and cool spring.
I'll take his word for it, but I'm keeping my raincoat handy. Heather Bosch, Cairo News Radio.
That sound you see was a vinyl record scratch.
Oh, yes, I know.
Okay.
Yeah, we know, Dave. Come on now.
I didn't know we were still recording voicers on vinyl.
Heather's using some of our retro audio devices here at the radio studio to pull off that report.
Make sure we don't run it on 77 or what was it?
78.
78,
Chris.
Sorry.
I feel
we had a cheap one. We couldn't afford the 78.
Days like today are tough with the rain and the wind, but, just looking at Sunday's forecast, even Saturday, sunny and 67. Sunday, we could hit 70 degrees. That's already sort of begun to lift my seasonal effect.
The anticipation is almost better than the actual
weather. Oh, isn't it, though?
It was 29 and snowing through Yellowstone in May. It was awesome. It was great.
I'd expect that from Yellowstone.
I mean, we were up at 8, 1,000 feet at some points. So, yeah.
Yeah, and look at that. Nick Allard's on TV right now showing snow up at the passes. Look at that.
As part of the city of Seattle's ongoing examination into what went wrong during the 2020 protests here in the city, we now have a new report on the psychology of crowd management. It focuses on the initial days of the protest. Cairo News Radio's Hannah Scott has more on this report, which was commissioned by the city's Office of the Inspector General.
The report, the result of analysis done by a global crowd psychology and policing expert based in the UK that was commissioned by Seattle Inspector General Lisa Judge, looks at the first four pivotal days of the 2020 protests over the police murder of George Floyd in Minneapolis.
This report really highlights kind of the inextricable relationship with, you know, how police actions are interpreted by crowds as being either legitimate or illegitimate, and the impact that really has on the ability to de-escalate or on whether the crowd gets escalated, right, by the actions of police.
Why does police legitimacy matter?
For me, the importance of this is really building an understanding and confirming how the legitimacy or illegitimacy of your actions as a police officer out there can really impact crowd dynamics. And I think it's a critical piece of understanding, you know, what really works to de-escalate a large group of protesters and what can serve to instead escalate them without intending to do so.
A judge says the findings of this report will likely have far-reaching impact well beyond the Seattle Police Department's policies.
You know, police departments around the world are paying attention to what's going on here, and I think this may serve as some really foundational stuff for other police departments around the world to build an understanding of how you relate with a crowd, what really can be impactful in terms of de-escalating crowds, really the critical piece of communication.
Chief Diaz says that's the idea behind SPD's new POET group.
So the POET is the Public Order Engagement Team, and they are on the front end trying to work with either the organizers or those in the group that want to have those conversations and have those dialogues. They want to make sure that they have a working relationship with the police department or the police officers.
And then it's big picture.
We have been able to, number one, identify things that really broke down during the George Floyd protest. And for us, it's really about learning about how we could have done things better and how we created these impacts in the community. And we have to acknowledge those impacts in the I've always publicly said it, you know, I apologize for those impacts and figuring out how we can, as an organization, adjust everything that we do.
That mentality shift worked well in the initial days of the Roe v. Wade protests that we're seeing in the city right now.
For me, as a chief, I really focused on trying to build a level of compassion and empathy in the department. And so this is part, POET is one component of kind of this relational policing initiative that we're focused on.
As for how all of the rank and file feel about all this change,
I'm encouraged to see all the hard work that our officers have done. But, you know, there's more to come. I mean, there's more training. There's more aspects to make sure that we instill this for the years to come. And what I also tell people, we're going to hire 100 officers over the next 5 years. There's, you know, that is 500 officers. That is half the department. So you're instilling people with this level before the badge, you're instilling them with this culture shift that we're really focused on. More, what I mean by shifting that culture, focusing on people's wellness. We know a healthy officer will create healthy outcomes.
Cairo News Radio's Hannah Scott. And we have Hannah. Okay, so Hannah, do we have you? Hannah, speak to me.
Yes, I am here. Sorry about that.
Okay, so I just listened to the report, and how would this communication, what would it look like on the ground? It sounds like the report basically blamed the police for going too far and actually escalating the situation. And are they saying that police officers should engage in civil conversations with members of the crowd? How would that look?
Yes, and exactly. So that's a really good example of this is the pink umbrella incident, right, which really set off the mass protests that we saw outside of the East Precinct and led to the creation of the Chaz Chop area. When, if you recall, I was in the front of that, and I had been following with these folks all day, and the organizers of that event just wanted to march past the East Precinct. And once that line was, though, created by the Seattle police, that no, it was kind of a standoff, right, for a long time. So the organizers and the people at the front were trying to engage in conversation with those officers on the other side of that barricade. And the officers stood there in silence and in their kind of riot gear, that, you know, looking threatening, I guess, if you will, according to those in the protest. So this science, this mentality that this world-renowned psychologist person does shows that that escalates, right? That does not help foster de-escalation. So what the people on the protest side, and I can attest to this myself because I heard them saying so, is they just wanted acknowledgement, really, from the police that, yes, they too thought what happened to George Floyd was terrible and that they had solidarity with these protesters. But instead, what you have is this threatening presence, literal dead silence that can come off as rude or not caring or whatever, and it tends to escalate even a few people in the crowd, and then it can get out of control. So the idea is to communicate with the organizers of the protest before the event even happens, if at all possible. And sometimes that's not always possible, but to always strive to have a communication line open with them so that if there's one or two or three or four bad actors in the crowd, those organizers will say, look, we don't want them here. Yeah, police, cops, take them out. Which I actually heard that day as well, but there was no line of communication to get that to the police.
And the reason the cops stood silent was because they were using an outdated analysis of the motivation of large groups, that anytime there's a large group, they tend to behave like a mob, and therefore mm-hmm. you have to take a hard line. That was their assumption. Right.
Exactly. And that's the other big takeaway from this report, according to Lisa Judge, that for the inspector general, is this completely like debunks that science. There's really, again, the mass number of the people in the protest want to do what they came there to do peacefully, have their message, right? And then you have these small group of bad actors who can cause a problem, but it's not that everybody wants that to happen. And again, I saw that on the Pink Umbrella Day. There was maybe 3-4 people throwing bottles, things at the cops, but the organizers of that event that was 10,000 strong were trying to quell them, right? They were trying mm-hmm. to control them and get them to stop, and there was just nothing they could do.
So going forward, is this going to be department policy that if you find yourself on the front line of a demonstration and the police say, we need to stop you here, you can engage in a dialogue with those officers?
Yeah, absolutely. So there's going to be, and that was the other thing I want to mention. There was such confusion with command on that particular day, especially. The officers didn't think they were allowed to speak. Many of them said privately in the after action reviews that they did want to express solidarity with those who were in front and at that protest, but they didn't think they were allowed to. Wow. So that's another thing that would be addressed. But yes, this is all part of the mental shift of the way policing is going to happen. And you know, it always seems like SPD is kind of just taking all the heat, and we're thinking George Floyd happened in Minneapolis. Why is SPD always involved in this? SPD has been in this consent decree process for so many years now, and really the nation's police look at SPD as a leader, and they will continue to with this science right here is the idea. This is stuff that's working in South Korea, in Sweden, places like that, where they largely have unarmed officers. Mm-hmm. That's also part of the conversation here right now.
Wow. All right. So it's just to check, because you were there, you've got more experience than anybody I know. You found this to be constructive, and you think it's going to make a real difference.
I think it could have made a huge difference that day. Yes.
All right. Hannah Scott. Thank you, Hannah.
You bet.
Jane Fonda's hot.
She is.
Still. Ow. It's a good show, too, Grace and Frankie. Your Daily Dose of Kindness is sponsored by Heritage Homecraft. Let's get to it. 104 marathons in 104 days. It's a feat for any runner, an astonishing accomplishment for the one we're about to meet. CBS's Mark Strassman reports.
Marathoners typically run on two legs and grit. Jackie Hunt Bruchma does it on one.
I didn't want to be an amputee. I was like, this is not my life. I'm just going to be normal.
20 years ago, at age 26, the South African native got bone cancer, a tumor near her left ankle.
Within 3 weeks, I went from cancer diagnosis to having my leg amputated, and I was like, no, I'm going to fight this.
Jackie's journey this year, in all, 104 marathons in 104 days. She raised almost $200,000, enough to buy running blades like hers for 50 para-athletes.
People are going to look at you and go, are you crazy?
I had to, like, convince myself, yes, this is crazy, but you can do it.
So your message is we're all capable of so much more?
Yes, that's exactly my message. You just go and try something hard, something that's personal to you.
Mark Strassman, CBS News, Phoenix.
Got to tell you, I've only run a 13.1, a half marathon. No itch to do anything more than that or that again.
Wow. What are those marathons measured in?
26.2 miles.
That's miles.
Yeah, so 2,724 miles in a row.
That's about 25 miles more than I want to run.
That's 2,000 miles more than I want to drive.
7:49, and now from the Gian Ursula Show, here is G. Scott. I was tuned in yesterday when you made the shocking decision to double down on your position concerning the Marysville School Board and this policy of requiring students to get parental permission before joining after-school safe space clubs. Mm-hmm. So explain where you are on that.
So right now in Marysville, they are going to, you know, if this happens, they would require a parent signature for you to participate in this. In all of my life growing up, all of my kids' life, them growing up, there was always a permission slip that was needed to be signed by the parent in for any activity. It's 2022. If I ask you as a parent where your child is at some point of the day, as a parent, you're going to know where your child is. I think everybody can agree that that's probably a good thing to do, mm-hmm. to know where your parent is, your child is. So let's just say that it's after school and it's 5 o'clock or 4:30 and you call your child and you ask your child where they are. What's that child going to do? Is that child going to lie to their parent?
Maybe.
And if they do lie to their parent, who's supporting that? Because I don't care what it is as a parent. You always want to know where your child is. And as a matter of fact, if something were to happen and we were discussing this on the Gian Ursula Show, the first thing I'm going to say is, Mama, how come you didn't know where your child was? Mm. So that's where and why I doubled down on this, because it's simple. It has nothing to do. And by the way, I love the fact that there is a club to support those in the LGBTQ community. Shout out to the school district up there for doing that. That's great. But you can't have it both ways. I don't think that you can try to do this without parent signatures.
So is that what we're going to do? They're going to say, okay, kids, it's up to you. It's solely your decision to join this club, which means you will be an hour late coming home, but your parents will not know where you are? I mean, I don't understand that.
Well, this would be a way of, because there are some kids who don't want to talk to their parents about this. There are some families some kids that feel that if they do go talk to their parents, that it would be worse for them.
They're not ready to come out. Yeah.
So they feel isolated.
Well, then are they going to lie about where they are? I mean, the parents are going to wonder where they are.
So when I say I double down, if anybody can help me better understand how a child can go and be a part of something without the parent knowing, and how safe, and if you do recommend something like that, I don't think anybody will agree with that. You can't recommend a parent not knowing exactly where their child is, and then if they don't know where their child is and they do talk to their child, isn't that child forced to lie to the parent?
I understand the after-school aspect of it because, yes, there is some accountability to the parent of knowing what their child is doing after school. But why couldn't these clubs meet during the lunch period, because that would be during school hours. Would you still need permission for that? Because I do want to make sure that we are considering that not all children can go home and feel safe with their parents, whether it be about their sexuality or be about anything else. They need a peer group to help them feel secure and safe. And so if we can't do it after school because of the accountability, perhaps lunchtime would be a good place for that.
So then that's inside. So that's probably a way
to compromise. But
that'd be the only way to keep it anonymous, because, you know, if I'm expecting my kid home at 2:30 and she's not there, yeah, I'm going to start making calls.
Right.
So you'd have to. I mean, if the idea was that the kid has a right to privacy, you'd have to do it during school hours.
Yeah. And it's just too bad, too, that we're still talking about this today, that kids don't have a safe place to go home and learn about their sexuality and ask questions. History is just repeating itself over and over again. You said a texter wrote into your show yesterday saying, ask Colleen, Marysville had support groups back in 2003, which you just outed my graduation year. But it was different back then. You didn't talk about sexuality. You didn't have those support groups. And so today we've made an advancement where they exist. But if kids still can't access them, we're still pushing them down further into a dangerous territory of depression, isolation, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah, I agree. I just think any event outside of a school curriculum, I think, should have parents and or guardian sign off. That's how it's always been. And I don't disagree with it, how it should stay that way.
G. Scott with Ursula, 9 o'clock on Cairo News Radio. Thank you, G. This is Seattle's Morning News. Dave Ross with Colleen O'Brien. The Justice Department wants transcripts now from the January 6th committee, including conversations involving people who are not yet under arrest, such as Donald Trump, implying the possibility of further criminal charges of the people who might be accused of leading this whole thing. Let's go to CBS correspondent Scott McFarland, who's been covering this investigation. Scott, tell us more about this.
This is a significant escalation in the investigations into January 6th. First of all, there are two separate probes. There's the Justice Department investigation of the 800 defendants accused of rioting or conspiring January 6th. Then there's that House January 6th Select Committee investigating all that led up to it. Now the Justice Department has asked the committee for access and copies of their depositions, their interviews, which is noteworthy for any number of reasons, not the least of which is it shows the Justice Department's trying to catch up to this congressional committee. But also, the Justice Department's prosecuting rioters, picketers, paraders, conspirers. The committee's talking to Trump's inner circle. And they've gotten interviews with some of the highest level figures, and it appears the Justice Department now has some interest in what they found.
Might it be because recently Donald Trump Jr., Ivanka, Jared Kushner, they all testified? Is that the testimony perhaps they're seeking?
The committee chairman won't say which records the Justice Department is seeking. But that's the delta here. That's the difference. I mean, the Justice Department has already gotten tens of thousands of pages on the people accused of being in the Capitol. They may, in fact, have more than the committee does. What the committee has is those interviews with the inner circle, people who had Donald Trump's ear on January 6th. And mind you, the committee's still trying to get more interviews with Republican congressmen, with Mark Meadows, Rudy Giuliani. But they have so much, it's noteworthy the Justice Department wants a piece of it.
What? Maybe this is a dumb question, but why can't they work together? Aren't they both going towards the same conclusion? Justice?
Yeah, and they might. You know, that's a great question, and they might, in fact, do that. I mean, the January 6th Select Committee says they can't share their work product right now because they're not done with their work. Their public hearings don't begin until June 9th. But the committee chairman told me they may allow investigators to come in to the office and look at things. They just can't get their own copies. I suspect both parties will find a way to work together. But that said, this committee is still trying to get high-level, high-profile interviews, including the names I just mentioned, like Mark Meadows and Rudy Giuliani. May not help their cause for it to be known they're sharing deposition records with the Justice Department.
What would the standard be for a criminal prosecution of someone who would be accused of actually leading this or causing this? Is it enough to just look at a bunch of tweets saying, fight for your rights, which could simply refer to, you know, lodging an objection in the Senate, as opposed to actually breaking down the doors of the Capitol? What kind of evidence would they have to
to make a charge like that stick.
What counts as conspiracy and incitement? Well, we're going to get a test case, and the Justice Department's going to get a test case in the early fall. The accused Oath Keepers, far-right seditious conspirators go on trial, nine of them accused of plotting and planning to attack the government seditiously. The evidence in those cases are signal messages, telegram messages, encrypted messages, the bringing of gear and equipment, a plan of action. We'll see how the prosecutors go about arguing that case and what the jury says. And that will give the Justice Department its first taste of how to prosecute a conspiracy case. Keeping in mind, almost all of those 800 defendants charged so far are accused of being pawns on the chessboard, not generals and leaders. Only a few dozen are accused of conspiracy. The Justice Department will find out by September how it goes when they try to charge and try someone for conspiracy.
Well, didn't the attorneys for the Oath Keepers try to get the trial moved out of D.C. because they were predicting that any trial held in D.C. would result in an almost instant conviction?
Yes, and they're still making that argument. They made it yesterday. They'll make it again in the days ahead. They're saying that D.C. jurors are biased helplessly because they were victims of this crime because of media attention and their proximity to the House January 6th Select Committee. The judge did not seem to be taking those arguments terribly seriously. But if that argument succeeds, if defense lawyers can pull that off, that might open up the floodgate to many other defendants who want to get far away from D.C. jurors, who so far have overseen four trials, and so far all four juries have convicted every defendant on every charge in a matter of hours. Mm.
I feel like this is a lot like the Russia investigation, where we waited years to get an answer, and then for a lot of people it was an unfulfilling answer. Do we have any idea the timeline of these investigations and when we might hear whatever the conclusion might be?
The House January 6th Select Committee has some pretty firm dates. They're going to have a series of public hearings, some in prime time, beginning June 9th. And they expect a final report to be issued after that's over. But one member of the committee told us, don't expect this to be a Marvel movie. Like, this is not going to be grand theater. So they're already dampening expectations. Mm-hmm. It's quite possible we walk away from this committee with an awful lot of paper, but a lot of mushiness. Nothing crystalline about what happened, who's responsible, who should be held accountable.
This should spice up the C-SPAN lineup at least a little bit, don't you think?
I think in the best case scenario, that's what's going to happen.
CBS congressional correspondent Scott McFarland. Thank you, Scott.
Thank you. You can ring my bell.
Ring the bell. This is Seattle's Morning News. Dave Ross with Colleen O'Brien. And Rachel Bell is here to tell us why you should ask for housekeeping service at your hotel.
Yeah, for years I feel like we've been getting the option to say, it's okay, don't come in, for environmental reasons. You know, you don't have to give me new towels, you don't have to change the sheets. Mm-hmm. And then during the pandemic, a lot of hotels just didn't clean all of the rooms as frequently because they were trying to reduce contact, which I don't really understand because usually you're not in the room when they come in anyway.
Right.
But now the problem is a lot of these housekeepers are not getting enough hours because the hotels are keeping that policy. They're saying, we're only going to come in if you request the service. Oh. Otherwise, we're going to come in at the end of your visit. And so the housekeepers union, they're pushing back and they're asking people to request the service, A, so that people can get more hours, but B, the house cleaners are saying, or the hotel cleaners are saying, it's far more work because when you come in every day, you clean up a little at a time. But if somebody right. stays 3 or 4 days, and now especially people are getting a lot of takeout to the room, they said it is way more work because it is a lot messier and dirtier to clean it all up at once.
Good point.
Yeah.
Oh, I didn't even think about that. So,
don't you clean up your own takeout, though?
I guess not. As some people are sex, drugs, and rock and roll, Dave. They just throw it at the wall and leave it. But the hotels are saying, hey, we make the rules. Like, we're going to tell you when we're sending the house cleaner in. I mean, of course, at the hotels where you have the option to request it, you can. But some of the hotels are kind of mandating, like, no, we're not coming in every day anymore. Mm. But, you know, I go both ways on this. I mean, obviously, it's hard when your hours have been reduced and you really need that money. But that's something that happens in our culture all the time. Like, certain jobs kind of end up fading out just because of new technology or cultural standards. That's a good example. Coal mining.
Yeah. I compare it to that because it's like, well, you know, as you see your industry start to fade and society change to allegedly this more eco-friendly mode in both senses, right? Like, don't wash your towels every day. It's better for the environment. Don't use coal. It's better for the environment.
Yeah. Yeah.
You kind of see the writing on the wall. And I'm not telling you to reinvent yourself into somebody new, but you do have to start planning for the future. Like like journalism, right? Newspapers, radio, all shrinking.
I bet I know when even you would call for a housekeeper to make up the room.
When?
That would be if you woke up with a strange dog in your bed.
Oh, the transition. I thought you were going to make a coal mining joke, something about Santa and coal in your stocking.
And I wasn't sure what he was saying about me waking
strange
up with dogs in my bed.
Dog in the bed,
we
Rachel.
We really ruined that transition. Okay. In Tennessee, as Dave said, a couple woke up with a dog in between them, which they didn't think was strange at first because they have three dogs. Yeah. But then they looked down and said, that's not our dog. We don't have a 90-pound bulldog lab mix. And the dog had its head on the woman's pillow. I mean, and
talk about taking liberties. And it wasn't their... Did I tell you? It's not their dog.
It's not... Yes, it's not their dog.
They've never seen this dog before.
To me, that's a blessing in disguise. A dog just appears.
So, I mean, for me as a cat person, I'd be like, excuse me.
Cat or dog? I'd be like, this is a gift.
So in the morning, they put up on a couple of the local Facebook groups, is this your dog? Whose dog is this? And so this couple claims the dog. They said, oh my God, he got off of the leash yesterday. We've been looking for him. But the embarrassing thing was when they came to get him, the dog didn't want to leave.
Didn't want to leave.
But he didn't want to get out of the bed. He was in the bed.
He'd become friends with their dogs.
Yeah.
And I think they just discussed it and said, you know, we're sick of sleeping with those people. Why don't you take our place
tonight?
Yeah,
you take a turn.
Or maybe that dog's not allowed on the bed or couch at his home. Oh, and so he's like, this is much better.
Well, because that's what they said. They said, we can't believe this dog sneaked in because they think what happened is that the husband didn't latch the door and it like flew open in the night or something. Okay. But they have these three dogs, three big dogs that should be barking when an intruder comes in. And they were like, it's cool. Just go upstairs.
Flew open
it's fine.
In the night.
Yeah,
the dogs have figured out how to open doors, and this is going to start happening all the time now. They're talking to each other, Rachel.
Are you positive that that's what happened? Sorry. Anyway, the people are all friends now, and they were wondering, why is this story in every newspaper? Why is it on Cairo Radio? Why is it on TV? Like, who cares a dog came
it's
in our bed?
Scary.
But
no,
they said,
it's scary? It's yes. cutie. It you cuddled with
I
them.
Mean, what?
Cutie.
So a raccoon crawls into your bed and you say, oh, how sweet.
Oh,
wow. You're going,
a dog to
you're
a
doing
raccoon?
A slippery slope.
Yeah.
In this situation.
Yeah.
What's next? They're going to marry hyenas.
What is a gala monster showing up in your bed?
If you live in Florida,
it's a dog.
It's probably already happened.
Oh, this happened in Florida?
Yeah. No, this,
no, no,
is,
this
Tennessee.
Is Tennessee. I'm saying the Gila monster would be a Florida thing.
Well, that's
thing.
Because the Gila monster has opposable thumbs and it can open a door.
Then a crocodile, then an alligator.
Well, this couple says, quote, I think that the world is just so full of negatives that people are thirsty for something positive and something good and something funny.
Yes.
A dog in the wrong bed brought us all together.
I love it. You know me. I'm on the Daily Dose of Kindness train.
I know.
So any story that brings the warm fuzzies, I'm
do you
all
own
about.
A dog?
Oh, I don't, but I do.
Well, then,
want one.
If a dog showed up in your bed and you don't even own a dog, you'd say, oh, what a blessing?
Yeah. I'd be thrilled. And my daughters would be thrilled because they want a dog.
I hope
but
dogs
I got a 14
aren't listening
year
old to this
cat.
Because you're going to get a visit.
All
so
the
you're
straight.
Saying you don't want a dog in your bed.
That's what I'm saying. Yes.
Okay, yeah. I don't either.
He doesn't even want a dog in his house.
I don't even want to pet most people's dogs.
No. I'm happy to pet other people's dogs. That's fine. You got to make friends with, you know, a wild animal. But I don't want a strange one wandering
animal.
Into the house.
I'm a bit of a Snow White. I'll take them all. I want a pet squirrel who I can drink coffee with on the weekend and share my nuts
you're
with.
You're a walking Disney movie.
I am.
Share my nuts with.
Yeah, my almonds.
Oh.
Come on now.
Okay.
That'll require housekeeping, too, probably. Rachel Bell. Thank you, Rachel.
Thank you.
Don't even get me started on pet fish. What if a pet salmon showed up in your bed?
Gross.
Yeah.
Is it Copper
See?
River, though? Because then I
go.
Could sell it for some Monet and buy some dogs.
Yeah, that's probably true.
Yeah.
Thanks for listening to Seattle's Morning News. I'm Dave Ross.
And I'm Colleen O'Brien. Thanks for listening to the show's podcast. We're happy you're here.
And you can keep up with the show and find some of the stories from today online at MyNorthWest.com.